Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
Well, they did it. They did it. They pulled it off. The North Koreans blew up a bomb. Apparently, a nuclear bomb. We're getting conflicting reports here. The French say it's a half a megaton. The Russians are saying it's between 10 and 15 megatons. Apparently, as I recall, the bomb that took out Hiroshima was around 20 megatons. So this is not an inconsequential event. George W. Bush pulled Prince Bandar aside. This I am reading to you from Bob Woodward's book, State of Denial. George W. Bush pulled Bandar aside. Bandar, I guess you're the best, expletive deleted, who knows about the world. Explain one thing to me. Governor, what is it, says Bandar. Why should I care about North Korea, asked George W. Bush. Bandar said he didn't really know. It was one of the few countries that he did not work on for King Fahd. Bush says, I get these briefings on all other parts of the world, and everybody's talking to me about North Korea. Fahd. Or Bandar, rather. I'll tell you what, Governor, one reason should make you care about North Korea. All right, smart Alec, Bush said, tell me. Bandar says, 38,000 American troops right on the border. If nothing else counts, this counts. One shot across the border and you lose half these people immediately. You lose 15,000 Americans in a chemical or biological or even a regular attack. The United States is at war instantly. Bush said. I wish these fill-in-the-blank holes would put things just point blank to me. I get half a book telling me about the history of North Korea. Bandar said, now I tell you another answer to that. You don't want to care about North Korea. You don't want to care about North Korea anymore? The Saudis wanted America to focus on the Middle East and not get drawn into a conflict in East Asia. I didn't say that, Bush replied. But if you don't, you withdraw those troops back. Then it becomes a local conflict. Then you have the whole time to decide, should I get involved or not involved? At that moment, Colin Powell approached. Colin, Bush said, come here. Bandar and I were just shooting the bull, just two fighter pilots shooting the bull. He didn't mention the topic. Mr. Governor, Bandar said, Colin Powell is almost a fighter pilot. He can shoot the bull almost as good as us. That from State of Denial by Bob Woodward. Here is George W. Bush saying, why should I care about North Korea? He didn't know the answer. This morning, the speech that was written for George W. Bush to speak. Here's the wrap-up of it.
Threats will not lead to a brighter future for the North Korean people, nor weaken the resolve of the United States and our allies to achieve the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula.
Like maybe threats against North Korea?
Today's claim by North Korea serves only to raise tensions while depriving the North Korean people of the increased prosperity and better relations with the world offered by the implementation of the joint statement of the six-party talks. The oppressed and impoverished people of North Korea deserve that brighter future. Thank you.
This is the guy who last week, well, it wasn't Bush himself, it was somebody in you know, a member of his administration, shall we say, who suggested that the North Koreans could have nuclear weapons, or they could have a state, but they couldn't have both. This from the New York Times. Yeah, this is Mr. Hill, Christopher R. Hill, the Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian and Pacific Affairs, said, we are not going to live with a nuclear North Korea. We are not going to accept it. A North Korea can have a future, or it can have these weapons. It cannot have both. And so Kim Jong-il says, oh, yeah? Boom! Now, this all goes right back. I mean, you go back to the timeline on this thing, and it is so straightforward. Back in 1994, well, it goes all the way back to the mid-80s. Ronald Reagan is president. 1986. North Korea has a nuclear reactor, produces plutonium. Reagan does nothing. 1991, George Herbert Walker Bush is president, and he says, you know, we need to talk to the Koreans. You know, they're estimating that they've got enough to make a bomb or two of weapons-grade plutonium. Let's have conversations with them. And Bush Sr. initiates conversations with the North Koreans. In 93, Bill Clinton comes along. Bill Clinton is president. And he says, okay, well, you know, let's carry this forward. He convinces the North Koreans to sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. And, by the way, says, we're going to aim our missiles at your nuclear sites. So that's like, you know, talk softly and carry a big stick. A year later, 1994, the Clinton administration reaches an agreed, what's called the agreed framework. North Korea freezes their nuclear production for the next 8 years in exchange for 500,000 metric tons of fuel oil a year. In other words, we're saying to them, okay, you guys are saying you have to have a nuclear reactor to produce electricity. We'll give you the oil that you can burn in a conventional power plant to make the electricity so you don't have to have the nuclear reactor. And Kim Jong-il says, okay, we'll do that. Especially since you've targeted your missiles at our nuclear sites. That seems reasonable. And then Bush comes along. Shrub, you know, Junior. Bush Jr. comes along. In March 6th of 2001, Colin Powell says he's going to pick up where President Clinton left off with his relationship with North Korea. We're going to continue. The next day, George Bush comes out and says, No, we're going to do something. Our negotiations are going to take a different tone. About 8 months later, Bush gives a speech in which he calls North Korea a member of the Axis of Evil. And a year after that, a year and 3 months after that, we invade Iraq, another Axis of Evil country. And gee, less than 3 weeks after we invade Iraq, North Korea says, okay, that's it. They pull out of the non-proliferation treaty. They restart their reactor. They shut down all the cameras that the IAEA has put in there. And within 2 years, by April of 2005, they unload their nuclear reactor and pull out of it 15 kilos of weapons-grade plutonium. And now they set off the bomb. See, the bottom line here, Bush he's dealing with these, he is afraid to negotiate. And now he's having to negotiate out of fear. It's the exact opposite of what John Kennedy suggested in his inaugural address back in 1961.
To those people in the huts and villages of half the globe struggling to break the bonds of mass misery, we pledge our best efforts to help them help themselves. For whatever period is required, not because the communists may be doing it, not because we seek their votes, but because it is right. If a free society cannot help the many who are poor, it cannot save the few who are rich.
And then he went on to add,
let us never negotiate out of fear, but let us never fear to negotiate.
And Bush has done both. Joseph Cerencioni is with us. I didn't see you on the board there, sir. I'm sorry. I hope you haven't been holding for long.
No, that's fine. I've been listening. Great show.
Welcome to the program. Joseph Cerencioni, he's a senior vice president for national security, the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org. Prior to that, he served as 8 years for director of nonproliferation at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace for 8 years. We're going to push the break back here a couple of minutes so that we can, because I know apparently you have to leave shortly, Mr. Cerencioni.
I seem to be programmed wall to wall today.
Yeah, well, that's fine. What's your take on what happened this morning and how this came to be and what we should do about it?
Well, I was listening to your description, and I completely agree with this. You know, this represents the complete failure of the Bush non-proliferation strategy. These guys came into office, and they rejected the Clinton and Bush and Reagan approach, which was you negotiate with your adversaries, you freeze programs, you walk them back, you reduce the weapons. You focus on eliminating the weapons. They said, no, we're going to eliminate regimes. We know who these bad guys are. We're going to go get them. The war in Iraq was the first application of this theory. It was supposed to go eliminate a rogue regime that had weapons. There were no weapons, but it set off a war that plunged the country into chaos. At the time, it was supposed to serve as a warning to the other countries. Then Under Secretary of State John Bolton was asked, what lessons should Iran and North Korea take?
Take a number. In other words, you're next.
Well, you're next.
And yeah, somebody says that to me, and I'm going to go out and get a nuke.
Well, that's exactly what happened. It's completely backfired. Iran has made more progress in the last 5 years than they did in the previous 10. Same with North Korea, and now they've crossed the red line. They've decided they've got nothing to lose. But if the U.S. won't negotiate with us without weapons, maybe they will with weapons.
Yeah. Joseph Cirincione, if I may play for you just a 15-second clip. This is the campaign ad that Dwight Eisenhower ran for president on.
He has met Europe's leaders, has got them working with us. Elect the number one man for the number one job of our time. November 4th, vote for peace. Vote for Eisenhower. A paid film.
Now, Eisenhower was the guy who resolved the original Korean crisis. He ran on a platform of, I'm willing to talk to the enemy and vote for peace. What has happened to the Republican Party?
Well, they've been hijacked by the neoconservatives. I mean, conservatives have nothing against negotiating. Look at Ronald Reagan, probably the greatest arms control president in history, negotiated with their adversaries. Richard Nixon negotiated with their adversaries. These guys came in with the theory that we don't deal with dictators, we overthrow them. It's proven to be a complete failure. We could have negotiated away the North Korean program if we had let Colin Powell do what he wanted to do back in March of 2001. We would not have a nuclear North Korea now to be worrying about. Yeah. The president's got to make a choice now. He's got to decide whether he's going to go with the pragmatist still in his administration, like Condoleezza Rice, or if he's going to side with the hardliners led by Vice President Cheney. I'm afraid if he sides with Cheney and Rumsfeld, this crisis is going to get a lot worse.
Do you think it's possible that we'll see a war in the Koreas?
No, I don't. I'm not worried about a direct military confrontation. I'm worried more that you're going to see more North Korean tests because they're still a long way from weaponization. This was their first test, but anyone who's developing nuclear weapons needs several tests to prove their design, to get it to shrink it down to a size that they can put on a missile or a plane. North Korea, if you start seeing them do 2-3 tests, that's when I'm really going to get worried, and that's when other states in the region are going to get worried. And they're going to start recalculating their nuclear options. That's the fear, that a nuclear reaction chain ripples out from North Korea to the region and around the world.
And finally, sir, one quick question. I know you have to go, but I understand that the Sixth Fleet is heading for Iran right now. We've got a large, a whole bunch of battleships heading in that direction. Number one, is that true? And number two, if so, how is this going to change that?
I've read the same report you did as well, that the Eisenhower battle group has been ordered to be on station by 21 October. Some say this is just normal procedure. Others worry that this is part of a November or December surprise, that there's still some in the administration, and I'm worried about this, who believe that we have to strike against Iran no matter what the consequences. I believe that is another debate that's not going to play out in the administration. This is something we have to keep a very close eye on.
Yeah. Okay. Joseph Cirincione, the Senior Vice President for National Security, the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org. Sir, thank you so much for being with us this morning.
Thank you very much. Sorry to be late. Bye-bye.
No problem. 20 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. We'll be right back.
Robot doll, tell me, live in the moment. Don't get too far ahead, don't live in the past. I blink my eyes and the moment is over. I guess another day has passed. But it's just another day. It's just another day.
And welcome back to listener-supported radio, the Tom Hartman radio program brought to you today by Sacred Grounds Coffee, saving the planet one cup at a time. And your support of our sponsors is what supports this program. 1-800-425-2532, all organic, all fair trade, sacredgroundscoffee.com. Small Dog Electronics, get the latest iPods now, 1-800-511-MAX, smalldog.com. And the organic wine company, 1-888-ECO-WINE. EcoWine.com. So the Koreans have set off a nuclear blast. The Bush administration. This is really interesting. We're going to see this play out in the midst of the debate playing out inside the Bush administration about whether or not they should attack Iran. We are soon going to see it play out in the Bush administration whether or not they should attack North Korea. And I'm pleased to hear that Joe Cirincione doesn't think that this is going to become military. It would be a disaster. The North Koreans have hardened emplacements in the hills surrounding the Demilitarized Zone, which is only about 30 miles north of Seoul, a city of millions. They have hardened emplacements where they can from there, using artillery, they can throw 500-1,000-pound bombs into Seoul. I mean, they could create a firestorm in Seoul. It would be like the firebombing of Tokyo. It'd kill millions of people, and there's very little we could do about it because these things are so deeply dug in and they're so well concealed, and they've been there for and they've got a million soldiers on the border, and we have what, 30,000, 36,000, and so you read Woodward's book and you discover that Bush is asking Prince Bandar, why should I care about North Korea? What? Why should I care about North Korea? Amazing. 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. We'll be back with your calls, 866-440-8466 and more right after this. And welcome back. Just a quick thank you to the 600-plus folks who showed up at Town Hall in Seattle on Friday night. It was great for our book signing of Screwed, the Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. And also thanks to Congressman Jim McDermott and the 100 or so folks who showed up the following day on Saturday at the University of Washington Bookstore. And Saturday night, I was the keynote speaker at the Physicians for Washington State Physicians for Social Responsibility. What a great group of folks. And these are people who are really out there doing the work. I'm just so pleased. And just a quick heads up, Friday, October 13th, that's this Friday, at 7 p.m. Actually, I'll be there at 6 p.m. At 7 p.m., there's going to be the viewing of the movie Red State. 1600 a.m. KOPT is presenting this. A radio station that carries this program in Eugene, Oregon. And it's hosted by Breakfast with Nancy host Nancy Stapp and me. And we're hoping that the mayor of Springfield and the mayor of Eugene will be there. They're so far unconfirmed, but looks like it may well be. Democratic Party of Lane County will have a voter registration table, refreshments served in the lobby. There'll be a Q&A after the movie with me and Nancy and the mayors, assuming that they can make it. So that's Friday, October 13th. Friday the 13th at 6 o'clock to say hi and sign books. 7 o'clock for the movie at the South Eugene High School Auditorium put on by KOPT. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. And Dan in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Dan, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I find it interesting that one of the guys that was in the Pendleton 8, that is one of the Pendleton 8 that were accused of murdering an Iraqi man.
Right.
I find it interesting that just shortly after the torture bill passed, that one of them had confessed to doing everything that was said that they had done, almost to a letter what they had been accused of. He said that they had done.
Right.
And so I'm kind of wondering if he wasn't possibly either threatened by torture because of this bill or possibly even tortured because of this bill.
No, actually... First of all, no, I doubt it. My guess is he was convicted. He figured he'd fess up and come clean. But the larger question is, if Bush has now said that you can put a person on a board and tilt them head down and pour water over their face so that they can't breathe and they're inhaling water and they think that they're drowning, or they can drown if you don't do it carefully. And strip them naked and pour cold water over them. You can basically torture people, keep them in solitary confinement for a year at a time, without any access to lawyers or anybody. Now the Bush has said we can do this, that these are acceptable. Are these acceptable ways for example, for police interrogation? You know, are these things that can be used on us? And that's a question that had not occurred to me before, but I think it's a legitimate one. And I don't know. It's creepy, but it's just to think of it is pretty horrifying.
Totally. I was worried more about the threat of being tortured, that they could use the torture as just a threat to make people, that's pretty torturous in of itself.
Yeah. I doubt it. I doubt it. But who knows? I just don't know. Go ahead.
I got one other question.
Sure.
A few days ago, I was watching Bill Moyer's Journal on the Jack Abramoff scandal.
Right.
And, there's so much information in there that is that people just don't know. There's a lot of people who don't even know what Jack Abramoff, what he did and all that sort of stuff. And I was wondering maybe if you could at some point do a little more explanation of what Jack Abramoff had done.
Okay. Another time, another program. But, fair point. 1-866-440-8466. Joe in Brookings, Oregon. Hey, Joe.
Yeah, well, I would just, want to wish the fascist news, the Fox News Channel a happy 10th birthday to that spoiled little brat called the Fox News Channel.
Here's the thing to keep in mind. Here's the lesson from Fox News, Joe. I would say that Fox News and right-wing talk radio have been very, very significantly responsible for the destruction of the American middle class and the right-wing takeover of America over the last 26 years, particularly over the last 15 years.
Uh-huh.
And I think that Air America and Progressive Talk Radio have really made a dent in the other direction. But the thing to keep in mind is that Rupert Murdoch lost $500 million. $500 million $500 million before Fox made its first profit. I mean, it was not profitable for the first 5 years. It cost $100 million a year to run that thing.
Yes.
Air America Radio is probably, I'm not privy to the inside numbers and things, but I'd be amazed if they've burned through $20 million.
Uh-huh.
And, in the 2 years or so that they've been on the air. And people are going, I haven't proven it yet. Come on. I mean, just look at Fox and you see what it takes to build a media empire or anything else. I mean, it's pretty significant. But, Joe, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Good point and well made. Henry in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Hey, Henry, what's up?
Yeah, how you doing today?
Good.
The thing I want to ask is this. Okay, like the guy called in reference to the Marines and stuff who confessed by killing that guy and everything.
Mm-hmm.
My thing is this. If the president can get a bill passed for him, Dick Cheney, Condoleezza Rice, and Gonzalez to be immune for prosecution for torture and any other laws they may have violated while they're in office, now how come that doesn't trickle down to the soldiers? Because after all, they are part of the process. And I wonder why these soldiers are still getting prosecuted for things that happened during a war action, because you don't know who you're fighting against. And
sure.
And let's face it, in the heat of battle, I mean, even a kid can come around the corner, you not know if that kid got a gun, grenade, whatever the case may be, and you shoot him.
Sure. No, I understand. The reason why Lindy England and others are not going to be let out of jail and other soldiers could be prosecuted in the future for, war crimes is that when you join the military, you give up a whole set of rights under the Constitution voluntarily. It's part of the contract of service, and you agree to be subject to the Uniform Code of Military Justice, the UCMJ, rather than the Constitution. What they altered last week was essentially the Constitution. And I'm sure it will be found unconstitutional that they did it, but nonetheless, that's what they did. And they did not alter the Uniform Code of Military Justice. So our soldiers, who are relatively politically disempowered. In fact, they're entirely politically disempowered. They don't have the power to speak out about politics. In fact, they can be court-martialed for doing so. Our soldiers are not in any way being protected by our legislature, by the Republicans in the House or the Republicans in the Senate. Instead, only the civilians are. Civilians like Bush, civilians like Cheney, civilians like Rumsfeld, civilians like the 35,000, as possibly as many as 70,000 civilian, very well-paid civilian contractors who are in Iraq, and the folks in the CIA and whatnot who are doing these interrogations or supervising the interrogations, they are all protected now. But the soldiers, no, they're not protected.
Yeah, but see, I'm retired military, and this is the thing that gets me about the whole scenario. Now, you're going to give them protection and everything else, but yet, you as a military personnel got to follow orders from these guys to conduct these situations, but yet you don't want to get prosecuted for them. Now, my thing is, if it's good for a soldier to get prosecuted, then doggone that man in the White House ought to be prosecuted, too.
Yeah, well, except that he's not subject to the Uniform Code of Military Justice. He's subject to civilian laws.
I understand that. So, I understand that.
But I agree with you philosophically. I absolutely agree with you. And Henry, I think it's a horrible thing that the Republicans in the House and Senate want to protect the civilians, you know, and who have committed crimes, but they don't want to protect the soldiers who may have. In other words, if they're going to redefine what a crime is, they should apply that to both. But, you know, I disagree with redefining what the crime is. But the point is that, you know, they're trying to get a get out of jail free card for their buddies, but not for the soldiers, because the soldiers aren't their buddies. None of these guys served in the military except Bush, and he deserted. You know, he was AWOL for more than 31 days. That's a desertion. And so, you know, I don't think that you could say that any of these guys, other than Colin Powell, really have any connection to the military at all. I think they view the military with disdain. So,
oh, yeah.
Anyhow, that's my take on it. Henry, thanks for the call.
All right, you have a good day, sir.
You too. Good to hear from you. Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Gary, what's on your mind today?
Good morning, Tom. I hope your schedule's probably laid out, but I hope you could ever have a chance to get into Western Pennsylvania here with your book signing.
We are working on it. We're actually talking with the folks at WPTT about putting together a book signing in Pittsburgh. Yeah. So.
That would be great. There's two. There's one race that's closing in closely here, mm-hmm. with Melissa Hart, mm-hmm. with Altmaier,
mm-hmm.
in a congressional race here. That's,
oh, really? Well, be sure to send a note to David about that. We should get her on if she hasn't already been on the program. Yeah,
Melissa Hart.
Yeah.
Boy,
she's a Democrat and she's running for the House.
No, she's the Republican. And
oh,
Jason,
who's the Democrat?
Jason Altmaier is the Democrat.
Jason Altmaier. So we need to get Jason Altmaier on the program. Okay.
Yes, sir.
Good.
I was just going to say I am very frustrated about one. And I'll let after I try to explain this, I'll put the phone down. I'll let you talk about it.
Oh, we've got about 20 seconds, Gary. So
oh,
to it.
And that, yeah, that's all right. And that is, you know, I go into Starbucks. I see the Starbucks crowd. God bless them. They're hardworking people. This and that. But I feel the upper middle income people and a level slightly higher let America down the last two elections.
Mm-hmm. I don't disagree, but I don't think it's I don't think it's out of class consciousness. I think it's for lack.
Well, we need to also put as other Democrats pressure on them.
Yeah.
I don't want to go down the river with them. I'm not going down the river with them.
There you go. Me neither. We're going to take this country back. I mean, that's got to be the bottom line. Gary, thank you for the call. It's 45 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program. Your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity.
I said, hold it, Doc. The World War passed through my brain. He said, nurse, get your pad. The boy's obviously insane. He grabbed my arm, and I said, ouch, as I landed on the psychiatric couch. He said, tell me about it, your dream.
And welcome back. Viagra for your brain. Just don't tell Limbaugh he'll want some. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, 9.5 minutes before the hour. And North Korea has set off a nuclear bomb this morning. By the way, I said megatons, I meant kilotons. Earlier at the program, one of our callers called to correct me. Thank you so much for keeping it all straight here. And the stories are still coming in about what's going on. Basically, Bush is strutting around, blustering. He had threatened them, but now he's got nothing to back the threat up with. All of this because George W. Bush, when he was, according to Bob Woodward's book, State of Denial, he relied on Prince Bandar for all of his foreign policy information. And he said to him, hey, why should I care about North Korea? Yeah. I mean, it's the idiot boy king. Oh, man. It is so sad. Ed, driving in Ohio. Hey, Ed, welcome to the program. Ed? No, Ed. Ed, we'll put you back on hold here and see if we can come back to you. Roger in Columbus, Ohio. Hey, Roger.
Hey, this is Roger. Hey, my point is that the vote on the torture bill was insignificant because the Democrats, prior to the vote, had elected not to be able to filibuster it. They had given the permission not to filibuster the bill. So each party voted down party lines, but they never even had to vote. Since the Democrats didn't have the power to filibuster.
So you're saying, I mean, but the Democrats voluntarily gave that up, essentially what they said. Actually, they still had the power to filibuster. They never gave up a power. They simply made a gentleman's agreement that they kept, which was, if you'll let us have open debate and propose up to five amendments, we promise not to filibuster the bill. And the reason why they promised not to filibuster the bill was because they had polled their caucus, and they knew that they only had 34 votes in the first place. So they knew that they couldn't sustain a filibuster. So why even threaten it? I mean, the Democrats, at least with regard to this, were negotiating out of what they knew what the cards in their hand were, and they were negotiating based on that. That's not what Bush just did with Korea.
I see. Thanks for the update, Tom.
You're welcome. Yeah, good to hear from you, Roger. Thank you. Ed in Ohio. Hey, Ed, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Good, good.
Hey,
but I'll get better. What's up?
I wanted to go back to something one of your callers said a few minutes ago that has been a fear of mine for a few months. About the new law that was passed that allows our own government to torture people, and they claim it's not torture, though. I believe that these tactics will be transferred over to our war on drugs. I believe that there will be times when people will, get caught with, say, marijuana, and government agents will torture them to tell them where they got it from. And I find it amazing that people don't realize that these tactics, once they're made laws, once they're made, precedents, they will slowly get through our legal system and be, once they're ruled legal, they will be legal for other things, too.
Yeah, and this is what our founders warned us about. I mean, this is why they wrote it into the Constitution. It's why we have the Bill of Rights. I don't disagree with you, Ed, and I have a lot of concern for that.
Right,
about that.
And I gotta tell you, just to let you know, I'm an independent senatorial candidate in New Jersey, mm-hmm. and I'm running under the Legalized Marijuana Party because I it's really a way of me,
Hello. Yeah, you're still on.
I'm sorry. It's a
you had
way
to take a toke there. Was that the?
I heard his beeping sound. I thought I got cut off. But
yeah.
It's a way of me protesting our war on drugs. And again,
well, that's great, Ed. You got a website? We'll let you give you a plug on the air.
Yes, njweedman.com.
Okay.
NewJerseyWeedMan.com.
NewJerseyWeedMan.com.
Yeah, go check it out. I receive a lot of hits. There's a lot of people who are involved in the ending the war on drugs movement.
Great.
And I receive plenty of safe
press
coverage.
The war on drugs is only helping the people who make drug testing kits and who run private prisons. It's not helping anybody else. It's certainly not helping people who have medical problems, legitimate medical problems with drugs. Instead, they end up in jail and where they just get ruined. The war on drugs is a disaster. And,
I tell you what.
And good on you, Ed.
Well, our government will never win its war on drugs because we, the people, want drugs. Me, myself, I prefer marijuana, and there's no way the government will ever stop me from using marijuana. There's no way our government ever, you'll never see a headline of a newspaper one day saying, the war on drugs has been won by the government. There are no drugs in this country no more.
No, I mean, it's, this program right now is powered by drugs. I've been drinking coffee this morning. It's organic fair trade coffee from Peru, Peruvian French roast from our friends at Sacred Grounds Coffee. So, I mean, it's a legal drug, but, they're drugs. Good point. They probably wouldn't want me to associate that with pot, though, so if that's the case, my apologies. Anyhow, Ed, and njweedman.com. Thanks a lot. Freeman in San Diego, California. Hey, Freeman, we have just a few seconds. What's up?
All right, I'm real quick. Tom, I used to think it was kind of petty of you to compare Lee Raymond to Fat Bastard, but then I saw a picture this weekend. He doesn't look like Fat Bastard. He is Fat Bastard. So,
come here. I'm going to eat you. I'm bigger than you. I'm higher in the food chain.
Exactly.
There you go. Yeah, it's spooky. I mean, that's why I do it. If you've ever seen the picture,
it really is.
It's Mike Myers. I mean, it's incredible. Okay, Freeman, thanks a lot for the call. Me and providing me with an opportunity to play that marvelous little clip. Oh, a lot going on in the news, and we will be continuing with that coming up after this, after the news here at the top of the break. David Bossie is going to be with us. He's a conservative. Talking with CitizensUnited.org, talking about the border war. It should be interesting to see how that discussion goes. Stick around. 57 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Herpin.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. And radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. David Bossie is with us. He's with Citizens United, dedicated to restoring our government to citizen control. CitizensUnited.org, the website. He's the president and executive president of Citizens United and executive producer of a new movie, Border War, that these guys have over at their website. David, welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks for having me back. I appreciate it.
I notice over at your website that an awful lot of what you're devoting your efforts to right now are things like getting John Bolton in at the UN, you know, call your senator for this, the courage of Fred Thompson, calling on Denny Hastert to step down. What is Citizens United just a conservative organization that takes different positions on different issues depending on whatever you decide those are or what the conservative take is? Or are you primarily focused on one issue?
No, we're the former. We explore and delve into many, many important issues of the day. And we do it based on what we think the important issues are going to be in the next 6 months or as well as the next 6 or 10 years. And we also try to look at issues that we think we can have a large impact in as opposed to dealing in issues that are already, for a better phrase, already taken, if you will. Like I don't spend a lot of my time. We are a pro Second Amendment organization, but I don't spend my time, or a lot of my time, talking about the gun issue.
Yeah, the NRA's got enough money to do that.
Yeah, I mean, that way we have a greater impact in the things that we can affect.
So here's a question for you, David.
Yes, sir.
You say that your organization is dedicated to restoring our government to citizen control. I assume that you believe, therefore, in democracy or in constitutionally limited democracy in a representative republic.
That is absolutely right.
Okay. If you poll the American people, even conservative polls, you find that the vast majority of the American people, depending on the poll you're looking at, somewhere between 70 and 90% of the American people believe that we should have national health care. You find that the vast majority of the people of the United States believe that corporations should be regulated and tightly regulated when it comes to the emitting of toxins into our environment. You find that the majority of Americans are concerned about global warming. You find that the majority of Americans are concerned about Social Security, and they don't want it privatized. They want a solid Social Security system. These are all positions that you're opposed to. How can you say that you're in favor of democracy, and yet you're opposed to the things that a democratic process would bring about?
Well, first of all, we have a democratic process, and it hasn't brought those about. But, look, we can, you know, that's the beautiful part about this great country. You know, we can believe in completely separate and complete and distinct different positions. We believe that those have that we are in the majority of a lot of those issues when it comes down to the details. You threw out a whole bunch of a litany of issues and polling data. You know, we could, once those things get, you know, onto paper and you discuss them in detail to the American people, nationalizing health care was overwhelmingly rejected over 10 years ago when Hillary Clinton tried to socialize it.
But it was rejected as a consequence of the health insurance industry spending $300 million on advertising.
But what you're saying is, but that's part of our process. Look, the American people make decisions based on the information that
if that's part of our process, and what you're suggesting is that the process is driven by money, and the industry with the largest amount of money gets what they want, and that's not democracy.
No, that's by far not the truth, because if you look at the immigration issue, which is one of the top issues of the day, okay, a bunch of folks with not even two nickels to rub together, band together, they call themselves the Minutemen, and they're out there standing a post in the middle of the desert, and they're up against Fortune 100 companies who want that labor. And they are totally outspent, totally out-organized, completely overwhelmed politically, but they stand their ground, and they make a difference. And now there are troops on the border. There is now financing for a fence, you know, albeit a small portion, but they have had a dramatic impact.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you, and I think that a large part of that is the result of their advocacy by Lou Dobbs. And this is, you know, one of those weird areas where probably in some regards, in fact, probably in most regards, David Bossi with Citizens United, you as about as conservative as you can get, and me as about as liberal as you can get, I probably agree that a nation, that all nations need to have some border integrity, and they need to have economies that are specific to their country. And in fact, I think that if even a small fraction of the 10 to 15 million Mexican citizens who are currently in the United States had stayed in Mexico, that they never would have elected a conservative in Mexico, and we'd have a progressive government in Mexico right now.
That may be that's actually an interesting point. And you know, look, they are exporting their people because
they're exporting their poor. They're exporting their economic problems, as you point out, our corporations are taking that on, and it's also a great social safety valve for the hard right and even the middle right, for the Vicente Foxes, you know, down in Mexico. And I think that's frankly, you know, a bad thing. I think it's a bad thing for us. I think it's a bad thing for Mexico.
The reality is this. They could build a washing machine plant in Mexico and employ a couple of hundred people, and every time they sell a washing machine to the United States, they get a revenue stream. Or they can export those 200 people to the United States, and they can send money back home, every single one of them, sending money back home to their villages and to their families, U.S. dollars on top of it, that basically, you know, run their economy. And
the government,
the Mexican government, is actually not only supportive but actually encourages it.
Oh, sure, I know that. I agree with you on that. And shouldn't we say, if you want to make if you're going to employ somebody in the United States who's not a citizen, sorry, you're out of business.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Okay,
and I think that,
number
look,
one.
I think
and number two. And number two, shouldn't we say if a company wants to, let's say, you know, Amway, you know, and or whatever, it's just, you know, some random company, if they want to set up a factory outside the United States because labor's cheaper there, let's say in Mexico, where let's say that something, you know, labor in the United States is $10 an hour, labor in Mexico is $2 an hour. I'm just pulling numbers out of the air here, for example.
Sure.
Shouldn't we say that that's fine if you want to build a factory in Mexico? We can't stop you. This isn't a dictatorship. But when those goods hit the border to come into the United States, you have to pay an $8 per item tax, so that regardless of where you make it, there's $10 worth of labor in it.
Well, look,
an import tariff.
Yeah, I agree with you on the first one. I don't know about the second. Look, the bottom line is...
So you're pro-free trade.
Yeah, I'm a free trade guy.
Why?
And that's okay. But look, we could disagree on whether we should have.
But that was Bill Clinton's idea. That, you know, the Republicans have historically been opposed to free trade. Smoot-Hawley was put forward by Herbert Hoover.
Well, look, we as conservatives want and embrace immigration. We just have a problem, and I think that's why the issue has come completely full circle on the illegal immigration movement, and they have regretted, in my opinion, making calculated mistakes back when they held their May Day parades, because the American people, one, are very forgiving, and two, they really don't care what everybody does. I mean, your average person in this country, they don't focus on it, and they don't understand just exactly.
But the bottom line here, David Bossie, is that we have a system where between global free trade, where jobs can be exported because manufacturing facilities can be set up overseas, and there's no penalty for importing essentially the fruit of that labor, that is the goods, or illegal immigrants can come into the United States and work, and there's no penalty to the company for that. In between those two things, or those two things combined, they are wiping out millions, probably well over 10 million American jobs, just in the last 15 years or so, and destroying the American middle class. And it's wrong. And by and large, I find it just amazing that although it's very helpful for the profits of very large corporations, but it's screwing the average person.
Well, look, I'm a fan of legal immigration. I want to.
And we all
solve,
are.
Right,
we all
I,
are.
I agree with that. But the
that's
the
not
problem
the point.
Is,
I mean, that's nice eye candy for Lou Dobbs. But that's not the point. The point is that the middle class is being screwed, and we need to. I think, frankly, we all need to collectively be doing the things that are going to bring back the middle class in the United States.
Well, I think this issue in and of itself, whether it's illegal immigration or any other, we need to focus on what the big picture is best for the United States as a whole, as opposed to corporate profits or, whether it's how it affects the middle class in the short term.
Okay, CitizensUnited.org and Border Wars, the new DVD, David Bossie, president of Citizens United. David, thanks. 16 minutes past the hour. Welcome back to the radio home of democracy. Tom Hartman radio program. By the way, announcing the October surprise contest on the Tom Hartman program message blogs. The first person to post the correct answer to what's the Bush administration's October surprise gets an autographed copy of my book, Screwed, the Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. The day after the election, we'll be putting up a poll so members can vote on the winner and four runners-up. Each will receive an autographed copy of Screwed, and the winner will be announced on November 13th. Or the winners, actually, will be giving out five books, a grand prize winner, and four others. George W. Bush coming unglued. This is from New York Daily News today. Bush, however, friends, aides, and close political allies tell the Daily News Bush is furious with his own side for helping create a political downdraft that has blunted his momentum and endangered GOP prospects. I'd say he's terrified that he's going to get impeached. Some of his anger, they say, is directed at former aides who helped Watergate journalist Bob Woodward paint a lurid portrait of a dysfunctional, chaotic administration in his new book, State of Denial. The book and the story over which or around which or, however you want to say it, that Bob Woodward says he got hung up on over. I mean,
have you spoken to the president or the vice president since this book came out?
The vice president called me, I guess, as it was coming out 10 days ago.
And?
Well, he called to complain that I was quoting him about the meetings with Henry Kissinger that he and the president had. I had interviewed Vice President Cheney last year a couple of times at length about material I'm gathering on the Ford administration, on-the-record interviews. But he volunteered. He said, oh, by the way, Henry Kissinger comes in and he, Dick Cheney, sits down with him once a month, and the president every 2 or 3 months. And Cheney was upset. I was quoting him, and I said, look, this on the record doesn't have anything to do with Ford. You volunteered that. He then used a word which I can't repeat on the air. And I said, look, on the record is on the record. And he hung up on me.
What do you mean? He swore at you?
He said what I was saying was bull something.
Let me turn to Tony.
No, but he hung up. Now, look, I can see, I went back and looked at the transcript, that he can ever had a disagreement about ground rules with someone.
Well, he thought he was talking to you for one project and used it in another project.
Exactly, but it had nothing to do with it, and it's clearly spelled out that it's an on-the-record interview. And so, now, what does he do instead of saying, well, okay, I look at it this way, you look at it that way? It's a metaphor. So what's going on? Hang up when somebody has a different point of view or information you don't want to deal with.
There you go. Bob Woodward just, you know, laying it right out. Hang up. Well, Bush, the administration coming unglued, apparently, and coming unglued quickly. And this... As I was sharing with you from the New York Daily News, some of his anger is directed at former aides who helped Bob Woodward paint a lurid portrait of a dysfunctional, chaotic administration in his new book, State of Denial. In the obsessively private Bush clan, talking out of school is the ultimate act of disloyalty, and Bush feels betrayed from within. He's ticked off big time, said a well-informed source, even if what they said was the truth. Well, you know, dysfunctional families tend not to, you know, tend to, well, this is just another example of the dysfunction of the Bush family right across the board, and the Bush administration, and the Republicans in the administration. Paul in Burlington, Washington. Hey, Paul, what's on your mind today?
Boy, you've got a great show.
Thank you.
Love it. And I don't know where you learn or you have time to read all this stuff and give the facts that you do, but it's marvelous.
Thank you.
I've got several comments. The first one, I guess, is to start out with, and I've not seen this on any campaigns anywhere, but, you know, just the statement that anybody that votes Republican is rewarding bad behavior.
That's a good way of saying it.
You know, if you vote Republican, you're just voting for more of the same.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
This country can't take more of the same.
Well, good point. And,
you know, you don't reward your kids for bad behavior. You send them the room or cut their allowance or do something, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Or at the very least, try and set a good example and,
yeah,
you know, point out their bad behavior to them.
Yeah, and that's hard to do for these guys.
Yeah.
The next thing is that I hear Bush and Cheney say, oh, cut and run, cut and run. Those are the original cut and run guys. Cheney cut the draft with 5 deferments. And Bush ran because he didn't show up for his duty.
Yeah, for a year. And anything over 31 days is called desertion. Yeah, so
yeah,
we have a deserter,
yeah,
as president, and we have a draft dodger as vice president, and we wonder,
yeah,
why the war is not working real well. Paul, good point and spot on. It's time now, and thanks for the calls. Time now for the Tom Hartman Program Progressive Pop Quiz. Today's question is, who said, let us never negotiate out of fear, but let us never fear to negotiate? The 6th caller with the correct answer at 1-866-440-8466 gets an autographed copy of my new book, Screwed, the Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. 27 minutes past the hour.
Today you're working for the man.
Welcome to the real free speech zone. No barbed wire fences, no RNC pass required. You will not get arrested for telling the vice president that you don't like his Iraq policy. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program, 34 minutes past the hour. Congratulations. We have a winner in our progressive pop quiz. Our question once again, who said, let us never negotiate out of fear, but let us never fear to negotiate? And congratulations to Mike Taube of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Listening on WPTT, Mike has the correct answer. And, in fact, I think I have this queued up right. Here's the correct answer in context.
So let us begin anew, remembering on both sides that civility is not a sign of weakness, and sincerity is always subject to proof. Let us never negotiate out of fear, but let us never fear to negotiate.
There you go. It was Jack Kennedy who said that in his inaugural address in January of 1961. So congratulations, Mike, and thank you for participating in our progressive pop quiz. And if only George W. Bush would have taken Jack Kennedy's advice. I mean, it was just common sense stuff. You know, let's not negotiate out of fear. Of course not. But let's not be afraid to negotiate. And I'm convinced George W. Bush is actually afraid to negotiate, that he's afraid to talk to people who disagree with him, that he will not have people who disagree with him in his administration. If he has people who are talking about economics, he doesn't like, they're toast. If he has people talking about military, he doesn't like, they're toast. I just see him as this very fearful guy who thinks that he has to have all this power because it's the only way he can control all those out-of-control forces all around him in the world. That he's just absolutely driven by fear. And as a result, his fear-driven policies are creating an unstable and unsafe world in which, ironically, more people are fearful. Well, maybe not ironically, I guess logically. People in America now increasingly being fearful they won't even be able to keep their homes. This article by Naomi Spencer. The social impact of the bursting of the U.S. housing market is already being registered in a sharp increase in home foreclosures. It's over at the WSWS.org website. In August, the foreclosure rate hit a staggering 53% increase over the same period a year ago. In Michigan, Ohio, and other states hit hard by mass layoffs in manufacturing, the impact has been particularly severe. In August, 115,292 new properties were listed on the database of online foreclosure tracker RealtyTrack, a 24% increase over the level in July. More significantly, RealtyTrack currently lists 650,000 properties nationwide in foreclosure or pre-foreclosure, up from, now this is 650,000. Guess how many there were just a year ago? And that was after Katrina, when a lot of the foreclosures were happening down in Mississippi and Louisiana. A year ago, it was only 75,600. So a year ago, it's 75,000. Now it's 650,000. The volume of bank seizures is immense. Foreclosures.com, another online tracker of distressed properties, currently lists more than 1.27 million properties in some stage of foreclosure, bankruptcy, or bank auction, and they're adding approximately 5,000 properties a day. A day. Currently, Foreclosure.com has nearly 11,000 foreclosures and 28,500 bankruptcies for Ohio. Michigan has 11,000 properties in foreclosure, 19,500 in bankruptcy. And then they go through, state by state. In cities built on manufacturing, such as Detroit and Cleveland, foreclosures and bankruptcies are highly concentrated. Just one county in Michigan, Wayne County, which includes Detroit. I used to live in Wayne County. Has more than 16,400 distressed property listings at foreclosures.com, up by 5,000 in a week. In less than a week. And every single one of these is not just, one small story or one tragedy or even one person's tragedy. Each one of these is an entire family's tragedy that in many cases is going to echo down from generation to generation. You're going to have, the children are traumatized by this and the damage that these guys have done. Since Reagan came into office, the damage that these conservatives have done to the economy of the United States with their free trade policies, the general insanity of their policies, their efforts to deconstruct and destroy the American middle class, stacking the National Labor Relations Board with Republicans who are hostile to labor so that the only institution in government, the one institution in government that is supposed to protect the interests of labor, it's why it was created, is now publicly telling employers how to screw labor, how to take advantage of labor, how to re-identify, reclassify, rename people so that you don't have to pay them excess money and all that kind of. The one organization. I mean, it's just a shame. Terry in Springfield, Oregon. Hey, Terry, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, I was going to comment about the conservative guy you debated.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't much of a debate, unfortunately.
I kept trying
to pin him down, and he'd move off to...
Well, one of the things I think it'd be wise to bring up is he brought up that when people knew the details of the medical socializing and stuff that Hillary brought up.
Yeah.
The millions were spent, and probably billions were spent to give misinformation. They didn't give details.
That was my point. It was $300 million. And in fact, what those ads did, it was a little over $300 million. And what those ads did was they said, you remember the Harry and Louise ads? And
right,
Harry and Louise
exactly.
Are sitting there and he's going, the government now wants to tell me what doctor I can go to. I can't just pick my doctor anymore. And she goes, oh, my God, we can't have that. Well, that's what Hillary Clinton wants. Well, it turns out that as soon as they finished running those ads and they shot down the government health care, all the insurance companies started telling you that they had to pick your doctors for you.
Exactly. And then on the immigration issue, he tried to point out that the Minutemen were bucking the Fortune 500. The Fortune 500 companies want the Minutemen down there. They keep that drives the immigrant population underground, which keeps them afraid, which means they can keep them cheap.
You think so?
They aren't trying to fight that. They're fighting where they fight is behind the scenes to keep NAFTA in place so they can keep getting the cheap labor.
Well, that's an interesting take on it.
They're not trying to fight the NAFTA, obviously.
I don't think the Fortune 500 care about the Minutemen, frankly.
No, and, I don't. But I think if anything, it's to their benefit to have these borders up and force them deeper underground, and keep them more afraid, and they're not going to speak up then, and they're going to accept their cheap wages and not fight back.
Well, that's a good point.
They keep them afraid all the time.
That's a good point. As long as they can keep there from being employer sanctioned, serious employer
exactly.
sanctions.
Exactly. And that's what they're succeeding in.
Then everything's
the Minutemen aren't solving that problem.
Yeah. Interesting. Good point. Good point, Terry. Thank you. That was a moment of enlightenment for me. I appreciate it. Mike in Kent, Washington. Hey, Mike, what's on your mind today?
How you doing, Tom?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
You will, I know, because you have a great show. Anyway.
Thank you.
What was bothering me today was the fact that the terrorists we're harboring here in the United States that blew a plane out of the sky back in 1976 that killed 73 people.
You're talking about the guy that Cuba wants to prosecute. I'm forgetting his name.
Luis Posada Carreras.
Yes, that's right. Posada Carreras. Yeah.
He's a former CIA operative, so they say. Who knows what he was? He was some spook that the CIA drummed up to go over and try to kill Castro. But anyway, getting up with Bush's rhetoric that anybody that harbors terrorists, we're going to take them out.
We've been sitting on this guy for 30 years.
Yeah, I know. And now the Bush administration won't basically tag him as a terrorist or non-combat, whatever the hell.
Right.
They won't put a tag on him. So he's basically going to be let free.
Yeah.
Venezuela wants him and Cuba wants him. And, of course, we hate Venezuela. They've done such, horrible financial damage to us.
They actually use oil revenue to help people
actually help
buy
their
food.
Country.
Oh,
yeah.
My God. I mean,
yeah. It's horrible. Put him in jail.
Yeah,
right. Waterboard this guy.
This is socialism. We can't have that.
Can't have that, man. Anyway, Tom, great show.
Thank you very much, Mike. Good to hear from you. I appreciate it. Jennifer in McKinleyville, Washington, is that right?
McKinleyville, California.
California. Okay, great. Thank you, Jennifer. What's up?
Well, I know you share a deep desire to see the Democrats take back at least one of the houses of Congress this year. And do you know about the MoveOn.org campaign? It's called Call for a Change. And people can call from their house and call to key. It's Get Out the Vote work in the key mainly House races throughout
mm-hmm.
the country.
Mm-hmm.
And they say that they kind of change all the time, so they're constantly targeting which are the most important races.
Right. For example, Foley's seat just went from not in play to very much in play.
Right. And they say that they've done the research and that if they get they need their people to make an hour of phone calls a week up until the election, and then 2 hours a week in the 2 weeks before the election, and 2 hours on Election Day, and if they get enough people to do that, they feel that they've done the research where that, you know, this will...
We can win the election.
We can
take back the House.
It's just a numbers game.
Yeah, and people can find out about it over at moveon.org.
At callforchange.org. And it's
call
something you can do from home.
Great. Callforchange.org. Jennifer, thanks for the heads up.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Bye.
Yeah, I had seen that. I'm on MoveOn's email list. You know, I send them a little few bucks from time to time. And in fact, I know Joan Blades, one of the founders. Anyhow, 45 minutes past the hour, the Tom Hartman radio program.
But we shall also do our part to build a world of peace where the weak are safe and the strong are just. We are not helpless before that task or hopeless of its success. Confident and unafraid, we must labor on. Not towards a strategy of annihilation, but towards a strategy of peace.
Let me say finally that I oppose the war in Vietnam because I love America.
With skillful manipulation of the press, they're able to make the victim look like the criminal and the criminal look like the victim. Right now, in New York, we had a couple cases where the police grabbed the brother and beat him unmercifully, then charged him with assault and death. They use the press to make it look like he's the criminal and they're the victim. This is how they do it. And if you study how they do it here, then you'll know how they do it over here. It's the same game going all the time. And if you and I don't awaken and see what this man is doing to us, then it'll be too late.
There you go, JFK, Martin Luther King, and I think that was Malcolm X there at the end. Today would have been, and over the song written by John Lennon, Give Peace a Chance, today would have been John Lennon's 66th birthday. So, an appropriate tribute. Today is also Columbus Day. By the way, one of the folks in our chat room says, Republican, well, basically, I scrolled up the board now, I can't see it, but during the break had said that MoveOn was just having people call Democrats and that's a bad strategy. They should have people call Republicans. And Alex, who's running the board in New York with Air America Radio, Alex Goldmark, you told me that your mother has been making calls. I hope you don't mind my talking about this on the air, Alex.
No, it's okay.
Okay. And you can pop on the air with us. That your mother's been making these calls for MoveOn.org, and she's definitely not calling Democrats.
Yeah, she says that a lot of the people are staunchly anti-Democrat and hang up on her a lot of the times, too.
Yeah. So
she's trying to find out which ones of them are Republicans, which ones are swing, and which ones are Democrats, and then I guess they give that list to other people, and maybe that's why some of them are calling only Democrats.
So they get, like, the professional, really know-how-to-talk-to-folks folks to call the Democrats.
Yeah, and yeah. I think for also in-person visits on Election Day.
Ah, yeah. Okay, makes sense.
Yeah, to get out the vote.
Cool.
Yep.
So thank you, Alex.
Sure thing.
Today, Columbus Day. Our quote for the day from Christopher Columbus, quotes, "Gold is most excellent. Gold constitutes treasure, and he who has it does all he wants in the world and can even lift souls up to paradise." That from Christopher Columbus in 1503, a letter to the King and Queen of Spain. If you fly over the country of Haiti on the island of Hispaniola, the island on which Columbus landed, it looks like somebody took a blowtorch and burned away anything green. Even the ocean around the port capital of Port-au-Prince, I've been there twice, I think, is choked for miles with the brown of human sewage and eroded topsoil. From the air, it looks like a lava flow spilling out to sea. If you consider Haiti, it's in many ways a microcosm for what's happening to the whole world. But it also, you know, today, Columbus Day. When Columbus first landed on Hispaniola in 1492, virtually the entire forest was covered by lush forest. The Taino Indians, in quotes, Native Americans, who lived there had an apparently idyllic lifestyle prior to Columbus from the reports left to us by literate members of his crew, such as Miguel Cuneo. When Columbus and his crew arrived in their second visit, however, they took captive about 2,000 local villagers who had come out to greet them. Cuneo wrote in his diary, When our caravels were to leave for Spain, we gathered 1,600 male and female persons of these Indians, and these we embarked in our caravels, you know, big ships, on February 17, 1495. For those who remained, those Spaniards who remained, we let it be known to the Spaniards who manned the island's fort in the vicinity that anyone who wanted to take some of them could do so to the amount desired, which was done. Cuneo further notes that he himself took a beautiful teenage Carib girl as his personal slave, a gift from Columbus himself, but that when he attempted to have sex with her, she, quote, resisted with all her strength, end quote, so in his own words, he, quote, thrashed her mercilessly and raped her, end quote. While Columbus once referred to the Taino Indians as cannibals, it was simply a story he made up, which tragically to this day is still taught in some U.S. schools, to help justify his slaughter and enslavement of these people. He wrote in 1493 to the Spanish monarchs, quote, it is possible with the name of the Holy Trinity to sell all the slaves which is it is possible to sell. Here there are so many of these slaves, and also Brazilwood, that although they are living things, they are as good as gold. Columbus and his men also used the Taino as sex slaves. It was a common reward for Columbus's men for him to present them with local women to rape. As he began exporting Taino as slaves to other parts of the world, the sex slave trade became an important part of Columbus's business. As he wrote to a friend in 1600, quote, 100 castellanos, a Spanish coin, are as easily obtained for a woman as for a farm, and it is very general. And there are plenty of dealers who go about looking for girls. Those from 9 to 10 years old are now the most in demand. End quote. Letter from Christopher Columbus. The Taino, however, did not turn out to be particularly good workers on the plantations. They resented their lands and their children being taken. They attempted to fight back. For even a minor offense, an Indian's nose or ear was cut off so they could go back to the village to impress the people with the brutality that the Spanish were capable of. Columbus attacked them with dogs, skewered them with pikes, and shot them. Eventually, life for them became so unbearable as Pedro de Corba wrote to King Ferdinand in a 1517 letter, quote, as a result of the sufferings and hard labor they endured, the Indians chose and have chosen suicide. Occasionally, 100 have committed mass suicide. The women, exhausted by labor, have shunned conception and childbirth. Many, when pregnant, have taken something to abort and have aborted. Others, after delivery, have killed their children with their own hands so as not to leave them in such oppressive slavery. End quote. When Columbus first arrived, there were several hundred thousand of these Native Americans. By 1516, the population was down to 12,000. By 1542, fewer than 200 of the Taino were alive. By 1555, every single one was dead. Every single one. Today, the day that we celebrate Christopher Columbus. 57 minutes past the hour. We'll be back. Tom Hartman here with you.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. And radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, the news is out. A new survey released today indicates that a majority of Americans are more afraid of being instant messaged or emailed by a Republican congressman than they are of terrorism, rising oil prices, or North Korea destroying the world with a nuclear weapon. Yes, it's official. Andy Borowitz reporting it over at BorowitzReport.com. Anecdotal evidence in recent days. Welcome back to the program, by the way. Tom Hartman here with you, 6 minutes past the hour. Anecdotal evidence in recent days has suggested that Americans are increasingly concerned about receiving unwanted electronic communications from a Republican lawmaker. But the new poll, conducted by the University of Minnesota's Opinion Research Institute, offers a measure of just how deep those concerns run. When asked to name their number one fear, 8% said losing my job to outsourcing. 10% said not being able to afford to fill my car with gas. 14% said North Korean dictator Kim Jong-il blowing up the world with a nuclear weapon, while a whopping 65% said being instant messaged by a horny Republican. Carol Foyler, the director of GOP Perv Watch, a watchdog group that warns parents about their children's internet contact with pervy Republicans, said that there are simple ways for parents to determine if their kids have been chatting online with GOP lawmakers. As parents, she said, it's our responsibility to monitor who our children are talking to online. If you hear your child start using phrases like tax cut, stay the course, or family values, those are danger signs that he has been chatting with a horny Republican. Thank you, Andy Borowitz, for that. On a more serious note, NATO's top commander in Afghanistan said Sunday that country was at a tipping point and warned Afghans would likely switch their allegiance to resurgent Taliban militias if there were no visible improvements in the people's lives in the next 6 months. This was General David Richards, a British officer. He commands the 32,000 troops in Afghanistan who are now, including the American troops, who are now under the control, I think it's 12,000 U.S. forces, now under the control of NATO. The Associated Press notes that the Taliban has made a comeback in the south and east of the country and is seriously threatening Western attempts to stabilize the country after almost three decades of war. As the general told the Associated Press, if we collectively do not exploit this winter to start achieving concrete and visible improvement, then some 70% of Afghans could switch sides. Well, I don't claim to be a prophet or a prognosticator or, you know, somebody who can see the future or whatever, but it is so apparent that the Bush administration has no plans on changing their policies with regard to Afghanistan or with regard to New Orleans. I mean, it's the same thing, basically. They believe that if they simply take a hands-off approach, the free market will solve the problem. The free market's going to step in and fill the void. Nothing to worry about. They'll take care of everything. And it ain't going to happen. I mean, we've been seeing the free market working in Iraq now for, what, 5 years? And we're seeing the so-called free market work in Afghanistan, just like we are in New Orleans, and it's a disaster. It's an absolute disaster. So it's another dark day for America, tragically. Nomi Prins is on the line with us. Nomi, NOMIPRINS.com, her website. She has a new book out. This is interesting. The author of Screwed is interviewing the author of Jacked, How Conservatives Are Picking Your Pocket, Whether You Voted for Them or Not. Hey, Nomi Prins, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Thanks a lot for having me.
Great to have you on here. Your book is organized by cards. I think this is a really neat device, literary device here, chapter by chapter. The first one, your driver's license. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, that's right. I organized it by cards so that people could think about their wallets, which is the thing that they touch and use every single day, 8, 9, 10 times a day, different cards. So the first chapter is the driver's license, which is the card that people take out or think about first, at least 50% of the time when I asked everyone around the country I met, what's the most important card in your wallet? And it connotes a lot of things. It connotes how much gas prices have doubled in the last couple of years, even though they are back by a little bit now, month before the election, but how people struggled with that, blamed the oil companies, rightly so, and also Washington for not doing enough to curtail things. I started my travels for the book. We opened in New Orleans, which is where I talked to a tour guide, and his business was screwed by, to use the title of your book, by Katrina, but doubly hurt by the fact that gas prices rose so much on the back of his misfortune and other people like him last fall, and they haven't really receded too much until recently. So that's a tough card. A lot of people around the country driving way too much, paying way too much, and don't really have a choice are getting jacked.
Yeah, and in fact, I found it interesting that the folks over at the Center for American Progress found this quote from 2004, where right after the 2004 election, George W. Bush sent a thank you note to Prince Bandar for the Saudis increasing oil production in the months leading up to the election to drive down oil prices.
Isn't that amusing?
Yeah. So here we are 2 years later, the exact same thing happening again. So we go from our driver's license to our credit cards.
Yeah, no, that's right. That was the second thing that people came up with. And the credit card is something that people don't originally understand when they think about it, what the connection is to Washington. But the fact is, there's a lot of
guilt and blame that people feel because they use their credit cards and because they have the balances that they have. And I think they really consider it the personal responsibility. But yet, a half of credit card use is because of basic needs. It's because of health emergencies. It's because of utility costs going up. It's because of a lot of different things. So I went around the country. I got tons of stories about this. This one woman I talked to in Connecticut had just given birth to a baby through an emergency cesarean. And I talk about her experience of getting home and hanging out with her mom in her living room, nursing her newborn son at her credit card company of years, with whom she has never missed a payment, would not stop hounding her like several times a day. And then they jacked up her rate, and then they gave her a late fee. And all of this stuff is completely unregulated. So what does Congress do last year? They pass a bankruptcy act that's called the Consumer Protection Act, which doesn't actually protect consumers unless those consumers own a Fortune 500 company.
Right. This is Republican legislation. It has to say the opposite of what it means. It's required. I mean, that's when you join the Republican club. You have to swear the oath, you know.
Good equals bad. Yeah, black
there
equals
you go.
White.
That's right. Yeah, you know, exactly. You have to do the whole, you know, welcome to Orwell thing.
And incidentally, MBNA, which is one of the biggest credit card companies, happened to have been George Bush's number one campaign supporter first time around. So there's no irony or coincidence there.
Yeah.
When we talk about war, we're really talking about peace.
Yeah, there you go. So, as you were saying, that was Bush with a little, you know. Yeah, what's up is down.
What's up is definitely down. And so the whole, and not only that, when they wrote this bankruptcy act, they made sure that if you were old, or if you were coming back from war, or if you had a health emergency, or if you had been fired from your company, who might also be declaring bankruptcy, you could not maintain and keep your primary asset, your house, if you had one, in the event of that bankruptcy. They specifically wrote those statements into this act afterwards.
Now, I know Texas and Florida are famous for allowing people to keep their houses in bankruptcy. It's why O.J. moved to Florida, for example, to protect some of his assets after the successful lawsuit for the murder of his wife.
Right.
Did the Bankruptcy Act blow that apart, or are Texas and Florida still havens for deadbeat billionaires?
You know, that's actually a good point. The part of the Bankruptcy Act does, I believe, state that if you have $5 million or more in assets, there's some sort of a loophole.
Oh, yeah, it's called an asset protection trust.
Yeah, so you are protected at the top level. So people around the country, if you have $5 million or more, I think it overrides. Yeah.
This is, Donald Trump declaring bankruptcy.
Right, right, exactly.
Well, he did in Vegas, you know, no problem.
Right.
So
right.
Okay, so that's your credit card. Employee ID.
Well, the employee ID or the union card or anything that connects people to their work was another card that we talked about as I went around the country. I mean, primarily through a lot of union workers. I spent a lot of time in Detroit, both before and after GM and Ford announced 25,000 and 30,000 layoffs, and then sort of tens of thousands around that on either side, and just talked to people who spoke of days when they worked for their wages, which they still do, and they had full health care, which they kind of don't because it costs more and they're being bargained out of it. And they had full pensions, and they could actually not have to worry about what was going to happen when they retired. And I was talking to guys who were like 30, 40 years in car, in manufacturing, working in the unions, and really have seen how that stuff has changed. I mean, for me, I was personally astonished by just looking at their photos, just looking at their lives, just looking how it had all been and how it had all changed, and how now you have GM and Ford in any company blaming workers for their health expenses, as opposed to blaming, say, Blue Cross Blue Shield, or blaming the government for not stepping in and doing something on a national level.
Well said. Well said. The book is Jacked, How Conservatives Are Picking Your Pocket Whether You Voted For Them Or Not, and it's a marvelous read, very readable book. Nomi Prins, NomiPrins.com, the website. Thanks for being with us, Nomi.
Thanks so much, Tom. Take care.
You too. 16 minutes past the hour, the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Welcome back. Happy 66th birthday. Wish he was still with us, to John Lennon. 21 minutes past the hour. By the way, Link TV is going to broadcast a four-hour special, Rich and Poor, Inequality in America. The first one was last Friday. The next one will be Wednesday, October 11th. That'll be day after tomorrow. Saturday, October 28th, beginning at 5 p.m. Pacific and 8 p.m. Eastern Time. It's a four-hour special, and I'm about 20 minutes of it. So, you know, not just because I'm in it. It's Bill Moyers is in it and a bunch of other great folks. A good chunk of Robert Greenwald's movie, Walmart, The High Cost of Low Prices, in it. It's just a fascinating show. I saw a good chunk of it, and I was there when they were, well, you know, I went down to get videotaped for it down in San Francisco. So linktv.org is all the, you can get all the information. And, of course, if you have Link TV and you know about it. And so just give you a heads up. We're going to your calls in just a second. First, let's just very quickly check out what's going on with the U.S. occupation of Iraq.
I want to know who the men in the shadows are. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are, but they're never the ones to fight or to die. And there are lives in the balance.
Security and other developments in Iraq reported on Monday as of 08:30 GMT from Reuters. Tal Afar, a suicide car bomber, killed a policeman and wounded 11 others, a policeman and 10 civilians. In Baghdad, gunmen killed Amar al-Hashemi, the brother of Iraq's Sunni vice president, Tariq al-Hashemi. In Baqaba, gunmen shot dead police colonel Faleh al-Obadi in the religiously mixed city of Baqaba. Near Baqaba, a roadside bomb targeted a police patrol, killing two policemen and wounding three others. In Basra, Ghali Najim, the head of the Iraqi National Accord in Basra, a party run by the Prime Minister Ayad Alawi, survived an apparent assassination bid on Sunday when a bomb planted inside his car exploded and killed one of his bodyguards. And in other developments, the trial of former Iraqi President Saddam Hussein and six co-accused resumes in Baghdad. Meanwhile, James Baker II said today that he expected, this from the New York Times, that he expected the group to depart from Mr. Bush's Stay the Course program. He's part of a bipartisan, the Republican chair of a bipartisan commission. James Baker, of course, the guy who was most responsible for organizing the strategy to get the Supreme Court to install George W. Bush as president back in 2000. He said that there are a number of alternatives between the stated alternatives of Stay the Course and Cut and Run. Yeah, gee, we all knew that. Republicans are just figuring this out, I guess. He says, I think the big question is whether we can come up with something before it's too late. Oh, excuse me, I'm sorry. That was one member of the commission said late last month after the group met in Washington. This unidentified member said there's a real sense that the clock is ticking, that Bush is desperate for a change, but no one in the White House can bring themselves to say so with the election looming. And against that backdrop, the number of U.S. troops wounded in Iraq has surged to its highest monthly level in nearly 2 years, this in the Washington Post, as Americans' GIs fight block by block in Baghdad to try to check a spiral of sectarian violence that U.S. commanders warn could lead to civil war. Could lead? I'd say we're there. 1-866-440-8466. Nancy in Winters, California. Hey, Nancy, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Hey, yeah, I have a question about the USS Eisenhower. A couple of weeks ago, retired Air Force Colonel Sam Gardner was in the news, and he was talking about the fact that a number of officers from the Eisenhower Strike Force had complained to him that they were being sent to attack Iran without orders from Congress.
Mm-hmm.
And if you Google USS Eisenhower, you'll find that they did sail on October 3rd. And I'm wondering, is Congress just going to go ahead and let this happen without any oversight from them? Have you heard anything about this? I tried calling my reps today, and, of course, it's Columbus Day, so they're not open. I'm just curious, do you know anything about what's happening on this?
I don't. It's part of a – what I know is that the USS Dwight Eisenhower is the second Nimitz-class ship that was commissioned back in 2000. And it's part of a battle group that's on its way to the Persian Gulf. I mean, I've read those news reports.
Mm-hmm.
But whether the officers aboard are you know, questioning or staging a mutiny or anything, I would be very skeptical about that. And yeah, I mean, showing up off the coast of Iran is different from attacking Iran. You have information that they've actually been told to...
No, I was just reading the article that was in Nation, and he and Gardner was saying that they were complaining that they were being sent. That was the way it was worded in this article.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. That was all I was referencing.
See, yeah. See, I have been saying all along that I think the 2006 election is going to be a replay of the 2002 election, where they do a lot of chest beating and war thumping leading up to the election. They use that to get to win the election, and then after the election, they have their war. We'll see. Nancy, I got to run. Thanks for the call. 27 minutes past the hour.
Oh, I am just a student, sir, and only want to learn. But it's hard to read through the rising smoke from the books that you like to burn. So I'd like to make a promise, and I'd like to make a vow, that when I've got something to say, sir, I'm gonna say it now. Oh, you've given me a number, and you've taken off my name. To get around this campus, why, you almost need a plane. And you're supporting Chiang Kai-shek while I'm supporting Mao. So when I've got something to say, sir, I'm going to say it now.
Well, maybe. Sometimes when you say it, you end up in the slammer. That's what happened to Steve Howards. Steve Howards is with us on the line. Steve, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
You are described in the news stories as a Colorado man who was arrested in June on harassment charges. An environmental consultant. He lived in Golden, Colorado. And what happened?
Well, this is probably the middle of June. I was taking my two kids to a piano class in Beaver Creek, Colorado, which is about an hour west of Denver. And I was just reading in the morning about how the death toll in Iraq was, you know, increasing, and who walks past me but Mr. Cheney. And he's there with a bunch of Secret Service agents, and he's walking through this pedestrian area in this ski resort town shaking hands. So I waited my turn, walked up to him, and I told him I thought his policies in Iraq were pretty bad.
Yeah.
And I can't remember the exact word. You probably know it better than I do, but it was... And I made a quick exit.
Yeah,
I didn't want to cause any trouble.
Right. I think you're quoted as saying, I think your policies in Iraq are reprehensible.
That's the word.
Yeah, there you go.
And I came back about 10 minutes later with my 9-year-old son, and this Secret Service agent comes out and asked me if I had just assaulted the vice president. This is 10 minutes later.
Yeah.
And I said no, but I did tell him the way I thought about his policies in Iraq, and I said, if Mr. Cheney wants to be shielded from public criticism, he should avoid public places. And then I said, if free speech is against the law, arrest me. In which case, a Secret Service agent, with my 9-year-old son standing there, grabbed me, cuffed my hands behind my back, and escorted me to jail.
This guy, the Secret Service agent, is named Virgil D. Gus Reichel, R-E-I-C-H-L-E, Jr.?
That's the man.
That's the man. Now, I'm curious, Steve Howards, your complaint, I have the printout of it here, the U.S. District Court, District of Colorado. It says, this is an action for damages against the defendant. This is the Secret Service agent, Gus Reichel, for violating Steve Howards' rights under the First and Fourth Amendments of the Constitution. Mr. Howards alleges the defendant violated his Fourth Amendment rights when intentionally, knowingly, recklessly, and with deliberate indifference to his constitutional rights, he subjected him to an intrusive, unjustified, and illegal search and seizure without any basis for believing he was engaged in criminal activity. I may be wrong on this, but I'm guessing that Gus Reichel didn't just come up with this out of thin air. Why not sue Dick Cheney as well? That's who he was working for.
Well, you know something, we're kind of starting off the tail of the dog.
Mm-hmm.
We know Agent Gus was the one who initiated the arrest, but was the one who actually brought the arrest, but we don't know what went on the 10 minutes while I was gone.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know whether his superiors told him to make the arrest. We don't know whether Mr. Cheney told him to make the arrest. We don't know exactly what happened, but we figured we'll start off at the lowest common denominator, and we will see where this takes us.
Now, is this a criminal or civil complaint?
It's a civil complaint.
Does that mean that you have the power to compel testimony?
What you need to do is I'd encourage you to ask my attorney, David Lane, about some of these questions. But mm-hmm. but as David has explained it to me, a Secret Service agent and federal employees are not immune from civil actions associated with the violation of an individual's civil rights.
Right.
And that is why this is a civil case and not a criminal case.
I see. I'm guessing then that you're hoping that you can get this guy, Gus Reichel, the Secret Service agent, on the stand and ask him, why'd you do this? And he'll say, well, Dick Cheney told me to, and then you can go after Dick Cheney kind of thing?
Well, I think we'll discover that before then. There's something called discovery.
Right.
And, we will find out through memos and through other information really what occurred behind the scenes, and then I think that will help my attorney, David Lane, better determine how we're going to proceed at trial. I think David said to the press that there is a possibility that Mr. Cheney will be deposed. There is a possibility Mr. Cheney will stand as defendant. But again, we don't want to get ahead of ourselves here. We want to we want to take the conservative approach, and we're going to start with the tail of the dog and see where it leads us.
I'm curious, Steve Howards, mm-hmm. how your 9-year-old son responded to this.
He was completely freaked out. When the agent started to cart me away, I had a box of shoes under my arm. I'd just gone shoe shopping and was taking my kid to camp. I don't think I really looked like a threat to national security, but my kid was terrified. And as he started to cart me away, I told the officer, I can't abandon my son in the middle of a public mall. I can't just leave my 9-year-old kid standing there. And he turned to me and said with a straight face, well, we'll call social services. Fortunately, my son had the instincts. He ran away, and he knew my wife was in the area. He found her, and as I left, we crossed my wife. She was in the path. She came to see what all the commotion was about, and my son was there, and she said he couldn't talk. He was so scared that he could not talk. So it was a pretty traumatic event, which is one of the reasons why we're bringing this.
To show your son that this is not America, how America is supposed to work.
Well, yeah, it's a very transparent attempt to suppress free speech, and it's one of a long list of it's a pattern that's emerged here with this administration.
Yeah, it's not inconsistent with their free speech zones, where at gunpoint, if you want to protest, they will herd you into a cage.
Well, and it's actually a number of people have brought actions, similar types of actions, although they weren't arrested, and we can only guess how many people had similar experiences but didn't have the wherewithal or the resources to bring this kind of legal action. So,
right.
We want to, it's our belief that this administration's frontless assault on our right to free speech poses a greater threat to the future of the nation than Osama bin Laden ever will. And we're bringing this suit to help heighten public awareness of what's going on here. To help my kids understand that this is not the way things are supposed to work in a free society, and to maybe send a message to the administration and the Secret Service that in a supposedly free country, you don't arrest kids taking their kids to piano camp simply for verbally and calmly disagreeing with the administration's policies in Iraq.
I'm curious, Steve Howards, if you know the fate of the, I believe they're called the Denver Three, the folks who showed up at one of Bush's things and they got dragged off for having a bumper sticker on their car. They also were suing the Secret Service.
Yeah, I think they're continuing to pursue that action as well. That suit was brought by another well-known Denver constitutional law attorney.
Awesome.
But, there was a little difference here, and that was they were escorted out. I was handcuffed and arrested and thrown in jail. And as far as I'm concerned, that's not minimizing towards the other case, but that's a notch up.
That's beyond the pale.
Yep, that's a notch up.
That is truly beyond the pale. Steve Howards, the plaintiff, Virgil D. Gus Reichel, Jr. of the Secret Service, the defendant. Have you heard from Mr. Reichel?
No, I haven't. I mean, they were very they were very glib in making their comments after I was arrested. They were very glib in.
What do you mean?
Well, they depicted me as a crazy. I mean, they said that I was arrested because I wasn't, this is a quote, I wasn't acting like other folks.
They said this to whom?
They said it to the media.
Uh-huh.
They said I wasn't acting like other folks, and that's why they arrested me.
No, you mean the other folks who were going up to Cheney and shaking his hand and slipping him a $500 campaign contract?
You know something? Your guess is as good as mine what that means. The reporters asked to clarify, you know, what do you mean by not acting like other folks? How does a person not act like other folks in a manner that justifies us being handcuffed and arrested? And at that point, the Secret Service spokesman would not comment further. I was hoping they'd be equally glib when we brought the suit, but so far we've heard nothing but no comment.
Yeah.
So to answer your question, we don't know. They haven't said anything. We don't know what's going on. But I certainly hope that they will think twice before they bring this type of punitive action against somebody who shows up to a rally,
yeah,
or to speak face to face with an elected official to express opposition to their policies.
One last question. We just have about a minute left here. We're talking with Steve Howards, who was arrested for telling Dick Cheney that his Iraq policies were reprehensible. In a civil and reasonable fashion. We have a correspondent with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C., who is an accredited White House reporter and has constant, and has for the better part of a decade, interactions with the civil service. And she tells us, and in fact told us on the air the other day, that a lot of the civil service folks she knows are so sick and tired of this administration's this kind of hysterical paranoia, that they kind of like to get back to the days with Clinton. Clinton actually, you know, people heckled him. It didn't bother him. Did you get any sense that any of other, you know, that Gus Reichel was a renegade, or was he being supported by the other Secret Service agents around Cheney?
Well, I will say that he wasn't the only person involved in this arrest. I don't know exactly how far the net went, how far the net spread.
Yeah.
But I will say that that it's really a sad day in America when this kind of thing can occur.
Well said. And probably Cheney gets to choose who he wants, and he gets, you know, his own little SS squad or whatever. But anyhow, Stephen Howard. Steve, good luck on the lawsuit. Keep us up to date.
Thanks a lot. Nice talking with you.
Good talking with you. 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you.
Well, it's a marvelous night for a moon dance, with the stars up above in your eyes. A fantabulous night to make romance, neath the cover of October skies. Yet all the leaves on the trees are falling to the sound of the breezes that blow. Yet I'm trying to please to the calling of your heartstrings that play soft and low. Yet all the night seem to whisper and hush, yet all the soft moonlight seems to shine in your blush. Can I just have one more moon dance with you, my love?
And welcome back, my friends. 9 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Oh man, I could listen to Van Morrison all day long. Back long ago and far away, back in the 70s when I used to do an all-night progressive rock show. Van Morrison, I forget which song it was. It might have been Moondance. Was my theme song. So anyway, a flash from the past. Welcome back to our program. Columbus Day, John Lennon's 66th birthday. Were he still alive, we miss him. And the folks in the chat room talking about how somebody, in fact, pointed this out to me in an email earlier in the week. Or over the weekend, the Constitution requires a Speaker of the House. And if you go back to the time of, for example, Tip O'Neill, when Tip O'Neill was Speaker of the House, he viewed himself, see, the Speaker of the House is a constitutional role. It's the third person in the succession to the White House. It is, there's you know, a job function there. It does not require, however, that the Speaker of the House be an elected official. It always has been. It's always been a member of Congress, but the Constitution doesn't require it. So maybe we should bounce out Denny Hastert and replace him with somebody really good. I like Amy Goodman. Amy Goodman of Democracy Now. I think she'd make a great Speaker of the House. There have to be, you know, we should be coming up with candidates. You know, who's going to be the Speaker of the House? Yeah, Tom Hartman, no. David, not a chance. I'm having too much fun here. Leon in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Leon, what's up?
Hey, I was just calling you. Thanks for taking my call. I want to talk about this, you know, kind of the mythological ownership society that Bush and company tout.
Well, no, it's real. What he's talking about is that those who own the most own society.
Right, yeah. There you go. But
it's like the golden rule,
you know. You know, they don't, you know, trade stocks, own little or small amounts of mutual funds. Their homes belong to the bank, and I think it's more of the on-your-own and owing society.
Yeah.
For
yeah.
most.
No,
and,
well said, Leon.
Yeah, and I, you know what I would recommend, folks? I picked up this article in Smart Money magazine, of all places, October 2006, that has a great article called How the Other Half Lives.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's eye-opening that, you know, this, we live in this lotto society. You know, everybody's going to, you know, win the lottery. And
yeah.
How few people participate in the wealth of this country.
Oh, you're right. It's very small, and it's becoming very, very concentrated, and the middle class is daily getting wiped out.
Right,
and
even the upper middle class.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, right. Well, yeah, it's if you're making less than, you know, $1 million a year, we're all in the same boat. I mean,
right,
it's,
exactly.
It's,
you're beholden to your health insurance if you get
yeah.
sick, you know, right on down the list. But,
yeah, yeah. Good point, Leon. I got to run. Thank you very much. Armin in Bradenton, Florida. Hey, Armin.
Hey, Tom.
Yeah.
There's a story out on the internet, and I briefly read part of it. And according to the story, Rumsfeld is pretty much significantly responsible for North Korea's ability in to develop the nukes that they now have.
Yeah, my understanding is that Rumsfeld was the chairman or on the board of the company that sold North Korea their first nuclear reactor. I think you're right on that. I'll have to double check on that, and if so, I'll report back on it tomorrow. I'm guessing you and I saw the same story, and it's out there and around. Jude in Seattle. Thank you, Armin. Good to hear from you. Jude in Seattle. Hey, Jude.
Hey, morning, Tom. Thanks for that interview with Steve Howard.
Oh, sure.
And also
thanks to Steve for that.
Yeah, well, it was excellent.
Yeah.
And also for coming to Seattle, you were great. Tom, I was wondering sometime, I never hear you read really any excerpts of your book, but I've read with about 20 people that I've encountered hiding behind the flag, and it's just those two pages. Would you do that sometime for your listeners?
The two page, the hiding in from Scrooge, you mean?
Uh-huh.
Sure.
Yeah,
sure.
It's hard to
okay.
describe it.
Thanks for the request.
My second one is on the Justice Department, and I just finished another book on that.
Mm-hmm.
And the three attorneys, Gonzalez, Bybee, and Yeo, back in 2002, mm-hmm. were the lawyers that ended up confirming the legality of torture.
Right.
The book and what's going on, no one has ever brought up, and you say this every so often when you stretch your mind and you say, I may be way out there. But this whole thing sounds like sadism. I mean, it is so beyond the realm of people that live in a world that want to survive and raise children. This
yeah,
is
I
like,
think it reflects a fundamental mental illness.
It's
I, you know,
very, very,
it's
very,
very clear to me.
And then my last one, if you would sometime, maybe there's a professor out of Georgetown University. He did the oral argument before the Supreme Court, Hamdan versus Rumsfeld.
Mm-hmm.
And his name is Neil Katyal, K-A-T-Y-A-L.
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful human being. If you ever get a chance, we'd love to hear him with you.
Okay.
Thanks for everything.
We'll track it down. Jude, thanks a lot for the call.
Thank you, sir.
Do appreciate it. Well, we're gonna wrap up the day here. It's Columbus Day, as mentioned, the day on which we celebrate Columbus's the first guy from Europe to come over here and take slaves, the first guy to engage in the sex trade. The first guy to genocidally slaughter an entire tribe of Native Americans. Pretty bizarre. But, you know, Columbus Day. Actually, it would be, you know, that would be a good segue into the story of Columbia. But I'll have to do that another time because we're out of time for today. Thanks for listening. And we'll be back tomorrow challenging conservative Dennis Avery on his statement that wind and solar power are going to fail because of high costs. Yeah, right. Remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.